This is an ABC podcast.
Kia ora tātou, ka salelia and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Ko Wingog o Egi Tupo, and we're coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up, Interpol, the world's largest international police organisation, are seeking a base in the Pacific. We'll look into the impacts of the Parliament House fire in Marshall Islands, and in just a few moments we'll cross live to the courts in Fiji to see what the fate is of those responsible for one of the world's biggest ever meth bus. More on those stories shortly, but I say me takimata. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Firstly, the men found guilty of attempting to smuggle more than 4 tonnes of methamphetamine into Fiji will know their fate in a court in Lautoka today. In what was one of the world's biggest ever meth busts, the men were charged in January 2024 with plotting to import the drugs worth an estimated $1.3 billion on a super yacht and through Fiji's tourist hotspot of Tinarau Island. The sentencing is set to be one of the heaviest in Fiji's history, and our reporter Lethe Mavono is at the court this morning. That Yanja Lethe, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Malolele and Yanravina Agnes, I'm at the Lautoka High Court where police are beginning to make their presence felt here, Aggie.
Wow. What can we actually expect from court today, Lethe?
At noon today, the High Court in Lautoka will hand down sentences for 9 people, 8 men and 1 woman, convicted in Fiji's biggest ever drug case. Prosecutors have called for some of the harshest penalties in Fiji's history: 50 years for the top tier organizers or the ringleaders, 30 to 35 years for trusted lieutenants, and 25 years for the others. The judge will weigh aggravating and mitigating factors, but Aggie, this could become a benchmark ruling against transnational cartels operating in the Pacific.
Mm. And look, I know the court case started back in May, but just a reminder for our listeners, what were some of the key findings that came out of it?
The case exposed how sophisticated drug cartels are exploiting Fiji and neighbouring Pacific Island nations. Evidence showed the meth was delivered at sea from a super yacht to Fantasy Island near Nandi, the gateway town to Fiji, arranged via satellite phones and encrypted apps, some of which I'd never even heard of before. The 4.1 tonnes seized in January of 2024 was valued at around Fiji dollars 2 billion, which is about 1.6 Australian, and the purity levels on these drugs were between 70% to 80%, which indicate that the amount could easily have been replicated while in transit. The judge did reject defense claims that they were acting under duress and that their lives were at threat, ruling that they were willing participants, Aggie, and that they had more than enough time and opportunity to seek the help of local authority. So the trial also highlighted weaknesses in Fiji's border controls and even implicating narcotics officers as well as police officers. However, the judge, in his initial ruling a month ago now, did commend the police for intercepting the haul, Aggie.
Okay. Well, Lethe, we know that, yes, 9 people are set to be sentenced. 2 have earlier pleaded guilty, and then 7 were found guilty by a judge in July. I understand you've actually spoken with one of these men. Like, can you tell us who that is, and what have they actually had to say ahead of sentencing today?
Absolutely. I spoke with Louis Longaivau, who is in his early 20s, and he is already considered to be one of Justin Ho's trusted lieutenants in Nandi, Justin Ho being the ringleader of this operation, to quote the judge. He pleaded not guilty and was hoping that he would be acquitted on the basis that he said he didn't really know what Justin Ho was doing. Ahead of the sentencing, he expressed remorse to me in an interview, and he said that he just wants young people, particularly young Fijian men who are vulnerable in terms of their financial difficulties, to seek help. And he's making it clear people need to seek help from people who genuinely care, not opportunists, which is how he's described Justin Ho. But Aggie, he could get up to 35 years today.
Wow. Okay. Well, again, this sentencing today is predicted to be one of the heaviest in Fiji's history. If this is the case, then, Lee, there, how significant will this be?
It would be historic, not just for Fiji, but for the Pacific, because this is the largest methamphetamine bust in the region's history, and I'm told maybe even extending to Australian and New Zealand borders. So harsh sentences would show that Fiji's judiciary, and by extension, our border police and local authorities, are serious about tackling organized crime, or at least drug trafficking. And that would send a message, but it would also set an important precedent for the region and tell cartels that Pacific countries are no longer safe havens for drug trafficking, Aggie.
Okay, so what time today will we know the outcome?
Well, the sentencing is scheduled for 12 noon Fiji time, 10 a.m. where you are, and we expect to know the outcome within an hour. But given that there are 9 convicted persons and each of them carrying multiple counts of various charges of importation and trafficking, it could be a 2-hour sentencing. Mm. The ruling itself was close to 3 hours, but Justice Aruna Alugethe has delivered a ruling that tells us what kind of sentencing we can expect of the 9 convicted people this afternoon.
Well, Lida, as always, thank you so much for keeping us across the situation. We will keep in touch with you once a result comes out. But again, thank you for being with us on the show this morning. And that was our reporter, Lile Mavono, speaking to us there from Fiji. I think it is time to head to some music now. This is none other than Kalitui. This is Vakawale Niau. Malo Dama e Bombongini, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We are in that time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines, and there is quite a few this morning. So grateful to have our producer, Kyle Evans, in the studio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Aggie. I'm a little bit sore today. I played basketball last night.
Did we win?
No. One of those games that reminded me that I'm in my mid-30s and not in my mid-20s like my opponents were.
Ah, that's all right. No worries. But hey, look, you're still playing the game. Well done. Look, there is a couple of breaking news stories that we're going to go through. This one is quite interesting. The man at the helm of Papua New Guinea's NRL franchise is walking away.
Yeah, look, this is the big one. Andrew Hill, who led PNG's successful bid to secure that historic NRL license, is stepping down as the chief executive and will join the Penrith Panthers in virtually the exact same role. So this news broke yesterday, right after the Panthers group confirmed him as the new CEO, replacing the retiring Brian Fletcher and taking over Penrith's suite of league clubs at all the different pathways. The reason ultimately, Aggie, was a simple one, in that this post will allow him to spend more time with family after years of commuting between Sydney and Port Moresby. But that's not going to ease the pain that this will leave the PNG franchise in the short term.
Yeah.
He had a wealth of experience, which he brought to that role as the former CEO of the Bulldogs, the former CEO of the Rugby League World Cup. And he's leaving the PNG franchise before the club's even appointed a name, a coach, or several key professional football staff. The Bears franchise, in contrast, has already appointed a coach in Mal Meninga, albeit joining the competition a little bit earlier. So, yeah, this one does hurt.
Yeah, it would leave a lot of things up in the air, but I'm wondering, has Hill acknowledged the impact his absence will have in any way?
Only that he believed that now is an appropriate time for a leadership transition, you know, with the new PNG NRL board now in place. However, there's question marks over the board as well. It was widely reported, as you would know recently, that the chair of the board, Wapu Song, stood down from the club's board amid corruption allegations.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's a couple of leadership gaps, which I'm sure will have an impact internally. But I think the bigger thing here, Aggie, is that I think perhaps this might be somewhat of a little bit of an early reality check for the PNG franchise, because that go-home factor will always be a risk when you're appointing Australian staff. So to me, I guess it emphasises that need to really develop things internally, both on the field and off it, because that's something they're going to have to contend with going forward.
Well, we shall wait and see on that one. Look, we're turning to rugby now, though, because it will be an all-Pacific affair in the opening round of the Super Rugby.
That's right. So the Fijian Drua will host Moana Pacifica in the opening round of the 2026 Super Rugby season in Lautoka. The announcement came by Super Rugby and came before any other details of the fixture was released, which is both surprising and interesting given the tumultuous off-season Moana has had. So to me, at the very least, this announcement was basically done to assure fans that Moana will be around next season, because, look, there are a lot of question marks around that after the loss of 15 of their players. The allegations around that use of government money, and obviously the departure of Artie Surveyor, who's I think heading off to Japan. So anyway, that match will come on February 14, Valentine's Day.
Perfect.
Will, you know, it's probably worst dates you can go to, isn't there?
That might be my date. and PNG citizens will be treated to a holiday to celebrate the country's 50th anniversary.
That's right. A three-day public holiday at that. That's what the government has declared in September to celebrate that massive milestone. So that holiday will run from Monday the 15th of September to Wednesday the 17th of September.
Okay.
And according to the national newspaper, the dates are binding on all citizens, businesses and organisations. And the government is kindly requesting that everyone gets out and celebrates to mark the milestone and the nation's history. So, look,
three-day holiday?
Exactly. Binding
Sounds
one at that.
Absolutely.
I don't think they'll be twisting too many people's arms. Take the day off.
All right. Okay. Well, look, thank you so much, as always, Kyle, for bringing us our headlines from around the region. That is your news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Fatalofatu, my name is Egi Dubowa. I'm your host here on Pacific Beat. Now, a warning for our next story. It does deal with the issue of suicide, so listener discretion is advised. Yesterday, Shane Christie, a proud rugby man, a Tasman Mako captain, Māori All Black, and tireless advocate for player welfare, died by suicide at the age of 39. Now, Shane was a leading figure in advocating for closer study of the connections between concussion and long-term brain injury. He suspected he was suffering from a degenerative brain disorder, which has been linked in the US to a number of suicides among players in the NFL. His passing has rattled the rugby world and reignited urgent conversations around concussion and long-term brain injury in contact sports. The ABC's Melissa Makin spoke to Dr. Alan Pierce, a neuroscientist at Swinburne University and a close friend of Shane.
Well, he was, you know, someone who we really connected with in terms of our, I guess, advocacy around concussion and CTE and he was obviously very devastated about the death of his friend, Billy Guyton, who he ended up creating a foundation in New Zealand to, you know, raise money for education and advocacy and research. And so we kind of bonded over that, and I, you know, was on one of his podcasts as well. And for me, it's still very numb and very shocking that, you know, for someone who was so passionate, you know, obviously beneath the surface there were demons as well that you know he was grappling with.
Shane was really open about the toll that concussion had had on him throughout his life after his playing career, and we'll get into some of those years that he spent playing. But from your perspective as an expert, someone who researches CTE, what do you suspect he was living with from day to day?
Well, what we know is that this is, you know, such an insidious disease that sort of develops very slowly, and so, you know, what we're trying to grapple with around CTE, and we're still trying to understand the effects, or is there any associations with increased risk for suicidality, and, you know, everyone seems to react differently and respond differently and develop differently. So, you know, for us, it's always a great shock whenever we get news like this, particularly from people that, you know, you don't necessarily think that there's something going on because they appear to be asymptomatic. It's not the classic type of symptoms that we would see with CTE. But again, as you mentioned from what you know, Shane had talked about, that he was behind closed doors dealing with stuff that he wouldn't show people as well. So you know, this is something that we really have to address, and every time that we get, you know, another player prematurely passing away well before their time, you know, this is why we need to do the work we need to do, because it affects so many people, not just family and friends, but the wider sporting community.
Shane pledged to donate his brain for research. So why is that step so important for understanding CTE?
Yeah, it's very important because, you know, there's some really big questions that we need to understand still. One is how much exposure it creates a greater risk profile. What level or what positions may be more at risk than others. But at the same time, not everyone we have analysed at the Brain Bank has had CTE. So I guess the biggest question of all is, well, who is more likely to get CTE? What does that mean? For even those that, you know, we end up diagnosing that they don't have CTE, you know, what other damage has occurred due to repetitive hits to the head over a career? And, you know, what lessons can we learn from that? How can we keep our games going but make them safer for everyone, so that it's not just during their career, but, you know, after their career, to have a really good quality of life and, you know, and not have these tragedies that we're seeing now?
This story raises pretty tough questions once again for the code and for rugby. In some of the responses that you've seen from the sport, there's been a lot of condolences, understandably, but have you been impressed by the response?
Oh, absolutely. I think it shows how loved Shane, you know, was in the community, and not just in the rugby community, but in the Maori community as well, and I guess in the wider Pacific as well, because of the achievements he did on the rugby field. And so, you know, it's so sad to, you know, read these messages of condolence, but at the same time, it shows how loved a lot of these players are. And you know, if any other players are reading these tributes, you know, if they're struggling to reach out to, you know, to talk to someone, because you know, we're all in this together.
You said that you're also wanting to not let CTE be buried in some of this coverage. So what would you like to see from Codes in the wake of his tragic death?
Yeah, look, I think one of the things, obviously we're still waiting to know if there is a diagnosis of CTE or any other, I guess, related injury to the brain. But, you know, as I've talked to you before and written about as well, that, you know, we don't spin this as a mental health issue. Yes, there are mental health symptoms and concerns that play out in the, in the big picture here. But underneath all of this is the fact that we're seeing, you know, very strong evidence now of micro damage and what we call neurodegenerative disease, which is what CTE is. It's a form of dementia. And so we can't ignore the elephant in the room on that. And at some point, there has to be some response from the major sports, you know, Rugby New Zealand, but also probably even Rugby Australia, because I think he played here in Australia as well for a bit, and really needs to, you know, acknowledge the risks here and what we can do better for these players.
And just finally, Professor, if Shane were here today, if he was seeing some of this coverage, what do you think he would want the rugby world and all of us to hear most loudly?
I think he would want us to, you know, say that we have to do better. You know, we have to do more. We can't just put a small amount of effort and resources and funding and say that we're doing a great job on protecting athlete health and well-being, because that's just not the case. You know, unfortunately, you know, Shane isn't the first, and I hate to say it, but he won't be the last. And we just can't keep afford to lose players, you know, retired players like Shane, but also those who played at club level who never represented at the highest levels. You know, it's the same for everyone, and we want these games to continue. We need to address the issue, and I'm hoping that that's what we can do for Shane's legacy.
And that's Professor Alan Pearce speaking to ABC's Melissa Makin. Now, if this conversation has brought up anything for you, please reach out for help. If you are in Papua New Guinea, you can call the Wantok Councillor Helping Line on 7150 8000. In Fiji, 5626 is the Empower Pacific helpline, and in Samoa, the Samoa Victim Support Group is 800 7874.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
That's Alofans, and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Interpol, the world's largest international police organisation, is pushing to establish its first regional base in the Pacific. As transnational crime and geopolitical competition intensify across the islands, the idea was a point of discussion at the 52nd annual Pacific Islands Chiefs of Police Conference hosted by New Zealand Police. And the plan has a strong backing from New Zealand's Police Commissioner, Richard Chambers, who joins me on the line now. With that, I say kia ora, Mr. Chambers. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
Appreciate it. Look, what decision did Pacific Police Chiefs come to about Interpol, you know, having to establish a Pacific base at this police conference?
Well, look, yeah, first of all, we came together as a cohort of police chiefs last week in Waitangi. I was delighted to host the annual conference. And we spoke about a lot of different things last week in terms of the sorts of threats to the region that we need to be mindful of, what we're doing together. But one of the big things we also spent time talking about was capabilities. What could we do more with and who with? And Interpol, and I'm lucky enough to have worked at Interpol myself last year as the Director of Organised and Emerging Crime, based out of France. And I have a good understanding of Interpol. So we were very, very lucky to have the Secretary General of Interpol coming to the Pacific last week at Waitangi. And that's the first time he's attended the Pacific Island Chiefs of Police Conference.
Mm.
And it was a chance for us as a cohort of police chiefs to talk about Interpol, you know, what capabilities they offer. Interpol is about connecting law enforcement agencies, providing additional support. So there was a lot of discussion. Secretary General was very keen to talk to us about what Interpol offers. They've got 196 member countries, 13 of them were there last week of the 22 that were in attendance. So really it was about understanding Interpol and how we as a region can lean in and be influential. So lots of discussion and certainly a lot of support for the suggestion that we might look to strengthen that relationship for law enforcement.
Okay, but Commissioner, can you tell us which Pacific police chiefs in particular were sort of in favour of having the Interpol base here in the region?
Well, as I said, 13 of the police of the nations that were present last week are members of Interpol, of the 196 country membership, New Zealand and Australia, two of those. And so there's already a number who have a relationship through the national central bureaus. So, you know, I mean, if you're a member of Interpol, you probably understand what they do globally and how they can support. They have capabilities that we can lean on. You know, global development, information sharing, all sorts of things that benefit law enforcement. So those that were in attendance last week, collectively, we decided, you know, Interpol's got a lot to offer us all in terms of strengthening capability and, you know, what we have to help do our job for the region. So there was, you know, high-level discussions about the opportunity. And there's a regional conference coming up fairly soon in Singapore where the Asia-Pacific region will talk more about the opportunity going forward. So there is a lot of work to do before any presence might be established in the Pacific, but the conversations need to start somewhere, and that's what occurred last week.
But can you confirm as to, you know, the countries that were there? I know you said 13 out of the 22. Is that nations like Tonga, Samoa, Vanuatu? Are you able to specify as to who actually?
Well, actually, I won't list them all. You can find that on the Interpol website. But of the 13 countries, New Zealand was one of them. Australia is another one. You know, so the other 11 nations can be found on the Interpol website. But, you know, the chiefs that were in attendance last week also attend a number of the Interpol events globally each year, whether that's the regional conference Asia Pacific or it's the General Assembly later this year in Morocco. You know, many nations have been members of Interpol for a long time, and having worked there myself, I have a good understanding of the benefit that being a member can provide. And it's about connecting us not just to law enforcement in our own region, about connecting to law enforcement more broadly around the world. So it's designed to help. Interpol is there to help us do our job in law enforcement, to ensure that we are considering all the different capabilities that exist to help us out, and, you know, what the trends are, and it connects us to, you know, 196 countries in terms of the information.
Well, and this is the thing, though, Commissioner. You know, what are the specific security threats or gaps in law enforcement, you know, capacity, do you believe that Interpol or that Interpol has a Pacific base would address that, you know, even current regional policing arrangements cannot?
Yeah, look, let me give you a couple of examples maybe. So first of all, globally there's agreement that the threat of organised crime is one of the greatest threats to security, safety and security globally. And the Pacific region is no different. So when it comes to organised crime and criminal networks, it's about understanding those networks, what's motivating them. You know, the Pacific region is a very lucrative market as well. So you know, we have a lot of work to do to ensure we understand the threat, the networks that sit in behind them. And Interpol can do that. And even when I was at Interpol last year, I ran an operation with a number of the member countries out of South America and West Africa and also Europe, where we focused on cocaine as one commodity, predominantly out of South America. And throughout a four-week period, The country's members, Interpol members that were involved, over a four-week period, 56 tonnes of cocaine was seized. Now, some of that product was heading towards the Pacific. And, you know, that's the power of Interpol in terms of supporting individual law enforcement agencies about understanding the flows, the networks, the threats. And it's just one more tool in the toolkit in law enforcement that helps us understand the global threats and the global tensions. So, you know, there's huge opportunity by bringing Interpol closer to the Pacific region. We cover 30%. I learned last week 30% of the surface of the Earth. You know, I mean, we're a very influential region. So being able to assert that influence more globally has got to be a good thing for our region. I look forward to helping with that.
Which reminds me, because earlier in the show we were talking about the fact that in Fiji, right, men were found guilty of one of the world's biggest drug busts, and they're actually going to be sentenced today. Was there any participation of Interpol in that situation? Because, again, we're asking, will Interpol be able to strengthen the intelligence sharing and you know, coordinated responses to issues like this across the Pacific?
Yes, look, I can't speak to specifics about the various operations that Interpol was involved in, such as that the Fiji one to which you refer, but Interpol has a secure network that allows information to be shared between member countries, and it helps connect law enforcement globally. So that platform allows us to better understand and try and get ahead of the issues, or when issues do emerge, at least we can share the information, and it helps us provide a much stronger response. But one of the things that, you know, I continually focus on as being important when it comes to membership to other law enforcement organisations is not just the supply side when it comes to organised crime, it's also the demand side. And if I think about the Pacific in particular, having been up to Fiji, Samoa, Cook Islands, and soon to head up to Tonga and other countries in the Pacific in the next few months, I think about the impact on communities across the Pacific. There are networks wanting to exploit the region to make money. It's also harming communities in terms of the demand, the addiction. You know, that undermines the safety and security of the nations in which we live, and that is something that law enforcement has got a big role to try and address. So other agencies are too. Health, and so one of the things we spoke about last week was how health has got a role to play in helping nations deal with the demand side as well and that addiction. So, you know, there's a lot to think about. And last week we covered a lot of ground. And the Interpol component of that was just one of them.
Yeah, I think I want to switch towards the fact that, you know, a lot is happening in the Pacific. And what I find interesting is that even the FBI has opened its first office in Aotearoa. We have the Pacific Policing Initiative from Australia. And then China is connected with policing units around the Pacific. Now, Interpol wants to lay their roots in the Pacific, right? Does it feel like it's a bit of a crowded space? I mean, what challenges does this bring to policing work in the region?
Well, you know, law enforcement's tough. It's challenging, and none of us as police chiefs can do this job on our own for our nations without looking beyond and saying, well, what are my neighbours doing? How can we support them? Particularly Australia and New Zealand, we've got a lot of proud history of providing support to the Pacific, and none of us want that to change. Certainly I don't as the New Zealand Police Commissioner. So, you know, I think it probably is symbolic of how important it is to stay connected to each other, understand the threats. That's not a new thing, but we're constantly looking for ways to strengthen the relationships and the partnerships, and that's why I've put a lot of effort into my, you know, building the relationships with my own Pacific peers, because that's what matters. We're actually all trying to do the same thing, and that's provide a safe and secure Pacific region.
Look, speaking of the FBI, though, we actually reported early in the year, you know, that agents were withdrawn from Micronesian countries as part of the US federal funding cuts. Do you think that sort of maybe left a gap in the net for drug traffickers?
Look, that's not really for me to comment on, to be honest. I mean, I was very proudly able to host the FBI director just a few weeks ago in New Zealand as they opened, you know, the Legate office in Wellington. We've always worked closely with the FBI. I can't speak to the relationships that they have with other parts of the Pacific. That's a matter for those nations and for them. But, you know, again, the FBI is another law enforcement agency out there that's wanting to ensure that globally their safety and security, and their commitment to the Pacific is clear in terms of the visit of the director to New Zealand and the office. So, you know, again, we're trying to do the same thing. We're conscious of the threats that can undermine that safety and security, and we welcome the involvement of the FBI, just like we do other law enforcement.
Thank you for that, Commissioner. Look, as we wrap up, I do want to ask, you know, there is also the issue of deportation. We understand that, you know, here in Australia, 501s being deported back to the islands. I'm just wondering, is this not adding to the rise of organised crime in the Pacific? And then I'm wondering, what then is the role of Interpol around this?
Yes, look, I'm very conscious of the impact of deportees. It's not a new thing. New Zealand has felt the effects of the deportations out of Australia, you know, but look, each country has its own position, its own policies. Absolutely, we acknowledge the impact that that can have. But, yeah, we work closely together and you know, we do our absolute best, whether it's people returning from another country for a reason that means that that other nation doesn't welcome them. Well, you know, it's not a new thing and it's going to continue. So we're conscious of that impact on the Pacific.
As always, look, we thank you for your time this morning, Commissioner. Thank you so much for joining us here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you very much.
Yes. And that is New Zealand Police Commissioner Richard Chambers here on Pacific Beat.
In the Whale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Pau Latukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the era to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Whale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Thank you, Tumas. Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. We head to Vanuatu, where the primary hospital is celebrating its 50th anniversary, having weathered earthquakes, cyclones and a pandemic in one of the most disaster-prone countries on the planet. For the past 12 years, Dr. Sale Vurumbaravu has worked at the Vanuatu National Referral Hospital, formerly known as the Villa Central Hospital. For the past 3 years, he's worked as a specialist doctor, which he told Lucy Cooper comes with its benefits, but rising costs and a lack of resources is placing a strain on the health system.
Firstly, it's a satisfaction. There's great satisfaction from treating your own people. I feel like when I is this an appreciation of the cultural layers, the health-seeking behaviours. It's great working with your own people and just being a specialist in helping my own people and contributing to the service development gives me a great sense of satisfaction that I probably wouldn't be able to get elsewhere. So I think that's one of the main benefits that I get.
And what do you struggle with the most being a doctor in Vanuatu?
Sure. That's a good question. Because we're a low resource setting, being a developing nation, we've got resource constraints at different levels. We've got financial constraints, there's budget constraints. Sometimes we might not have all the tests that we can do. And that certainly affects our job as diagnosticians because most of our job is derived from clinical examination of the patients and history taking. But a lot of the time you need to do blood tests and some of those tests, the reagent might be out of stock at certain points in time. So that makes our job a bit more challenging. But I guess the way we were trained was to be clinical doctors. So we have to rely a lot on our history taking and clinical examination. I guess those are some of the constraints. Apart from that, I think public perceptions and health-seeking behavior sort of makes our work especially more difficult. And by that, I mean, I think there is a lot of work to be done in terms of health promotion, in terms of making the general public understand the role of the hospital. Because we have a strong Melanesian culture, often there is complementary and alternative medicine running in the background. And people will do witch doctor shopping, so to speak. That means they go and see different witch doctors for something like a toe infection, which ends up being diabetic foot sepsis, which requires amputation because the person had been seeing different traditional healers. And by the time they come to us, we have to amputate the leg. So there's a bit of misinformation from that point of view. And I think with the rise and advent of social media, there's a lot of misinformation out there. Currently, we're facing challenges with our vaccination programs around the country. Especially, we have an outbreak of pertussis, whooping cough, in one of our islands. And some of that might be attributed to misinformation about the safety of vaccines. Especially after COVID and COVID vaccination, I think there's a lot of misinformation going out there on social media. So I think that makes our job a bit difficult. And I think the main constraint that we have is our lack of human resource. We don't have sufficient staffing. We have about 40%, 40 to 50% of our positions are filled. So we have a vacancy of 50% in the entire Ministry of Health, which means we don't have nearly as much doctors and nurses and allied health and other people that we need. So basically, it's like a chair running on two legs. Two legs are missing, so it's hard to build a reliable service on that. So I think those are some of our constraints and challenges.
It's 50 years of the hospital and looking towards the next 50. What would you really like to see change or implemented at the hospital to improve the services that you guys offer?
I think we need to really start sending more people, more of our brightest minds in high school to university. We currently have 87 doctors. We need to hit about 400 or 300 doctors. We have, I think, perhaps 300 nurses, we need 900 nurses. 50 years, I think, we have to start looking at enhancing the level of care we provide in a feasible manner. There's a lot of things that we are sending people overseas for medical treatment, like in India or Fiji. I have to mention that we've actually tripled our workforce in terms of doctors in the last 30 years, probably more than that. I read a hospital report from the same hospital I'm working at in 1992. We had four local doctors, and fast forward 33 years later, we've got 87. So I think we've gone from 4 to 87, so that's pretty good. We've localized all the specialist posts, so I think we're on the right track. We just need more of the same, more budget, more staffing, and smarter policies, I suppose.
And that is Dr. Sale Vurumbaravu, a specialist doctor at the Vanuatu National Referral Hospital, speaking with Lucy Cooper.
Pacific Beat.
Now, the fire that swept through the Netindiela Marshall Islands Parliament building could not have come at a worse time. Not only has it created a major operational headache for government, but the fire has also disrupted funeral plans for the late former President Christopher Luaek. Following his death in Hawaii earlier this month, his remains were due to lie in state in the Netindiela on their return to Majuro. So, what's going to happen? Well, for the latest, we're joined by the editor of the Marshall Islands Journal, Gift Johnson. Good morning, Gith, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Happy to be here.
Appreciate it. Well, look, is there a contingency plan in place? I think, will the lying in state go ahead at another venue?
Yes, this is the one thing that we can say about the Marshall Islands is there's always a plan B and C and D. So, you know, you live in a place like this, you just have to be able to roll with things like this. And, of course, normally state funerals are held at the Parliament building. That's the tradition. But as most people now are aware, the Parliament building in Majuro, the capital of the Marshall Islands, burned up overnight Monday, Tuesday, and it's a total loss. So what's happening is the president's remains and family members are flying in later this afternoon from Honolulu, and they will go straight into a state funeral, which is going to be held at the United Church of Christ headquarters church in downtown Majuro. And just for perspective on this is the United Church of Christ is the original church of the Marshall Islands that was established by Boston missionaries 160 or 70 years ago. And it's also the church where when the late president took up the seat as an Iroj Loplop or paramount chief, it's where he held his ceremony for becoming a paramount chief in this church. So it's quite fitting. I mean, it's not, it doesn't it isn't the same as doing it in Parliament, but I think everybody will be happy doing it there.
And I think that's the thing, though, Giff, because, you know, Christopher Lloyd was a popular president, right, with a very down-to-earth reputation. So I'm wondering, or I can only imagine, many Marshall Islanders would want to pay their respects, yes?
Oh, yeah, it's a huge event, the funeral. I mean, in Honolulu, the memorial service at Central Union Church in Honolulu. And then here, of course, there have been radio announcements going since yesterday announcing the different groups that will be coming both to the church and then to the family residence, because he'll be moved after the formal state funeral later this afternoon. Once that concludes, they'll move the body out to the family residence, and then funeral services will continue for the next several days. And already, the groups, the various chiefs, the island groups, the family groups, they're all mobilizing to be at the funeral. So, yeah, it's going to be a huge thing with thousands and thousands of people coming to pay respects.
Giff, how would you assess Mr. Loic's legacy? Because, there were a couple of things that he was, instrumental in, especially being at the helm at a crucial time back in 2015 when the Paris Climate Change Agreement was sealed. And I know Marshall Islands, had a big part to play in that.
This is true. And Chris Loic was president from 2012 to 2016, and he had put Tony DeBroom in first as his environment minister, and Tony became, a huge figure in the global climate movement, and then by 2015, Tony DeBroom was his foreign minister and played this pivotal role in Paris at the COP in Paris in 2015, which really set the standard for all the climate work that's followed since that Paris Agreement was signed. And this is because Chris was president. He put Tony in position to do this, supported him. And, the thing is, I've known him since, I've lived here for a long time. And I first met Chris Loic in the 1980s. And it's what you say is really true. He's just a very down-to-earth, low-key, interested individual, and just had, had good relations with people. And when he was in government, the climate issue was a very hot burner issue, as it's been for everybody, in the last 10 years. And they did a lot of work on it. And, even after he was out of the presidency, he was still in the parliament and then moved into his role as the paramount chief for the Loic family is one of the top couple of chiefly families, royal families in the Marshall Islands. So he stepped down from his parliament chair in order to concentrate on that a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so do you think, though, Giff, did he actually have much to say about the climate change battle after he left office? Because I'm just thinking, would he have been disappointed or disheartened about the way the Paris deal has been undermined, and not least by Donald Trump, of course?
I don't think anybody who lives on an atoll is happy to see the state of play internationally in the climate sphere when you have so many, big countries that just keep trying to put things off or simply deny that there are effects. And, he filmed, I know that Chris Loic had quite a number of media interviews at his place, which is right on on an atoll, you're always right next to the water. But he was right on the ocean side. He had a seawall built to, keep the high tides out of his place. And he had numerous interviews over there. And it's the how close we are to the ocean on an atoll. It just makes you realize, you know, even just millimeters, centimeters of change result in flooding and inundations on these low islands. And so, you know, the work to mitigate and adapt is huge. And when we hear, you know, like the United States just throwing climate out the window, getting rid of any climate action when that's the top security issue in the Pacific Islands. I mean, what does that say to the Pacific Island leaders and people about the U.S. relationship with the region? I mean, it's a real black mark on America. But there's plenty of other big countries that are not doing what they need to be doing as well.
Giff, look, just finally, I do want to quickly touch on, of course, the Nitiela fire. Has the cause been established yet? And do you know what's going to happen to Parliament, which I know is still in session, right? Do they have somewhere else to go?
Parliament is in session, although now, of course, it's on a few day break. They've been setting up since yesterday in the International Conference Center, which is a big area, big conference center where they've hosted big events with a lot of, you know, a lot of speakers and representatives. So it will work as a temporary facility for now. I think they'll have it up and running for next week. I think the state funeral and so on for the late Chris Loyock will kind of take precedence priority this week, today and tomorrow, and then early next week, Parliament will probably get back to business. Now, as well, the cabinet met Tuesday, right? The fire was still going at the Parliament. They had an emergency meeting, and they decided that they will put on a fast track building a new Parliament building. And the president announced Tuesday afternoon the plan to start construction of a new Parliament building before the end of this year. So that's something that they're very focused on, getting that off the ground and moving. So I imagine we'll see what's left of the Parliament building demolished fairly soon, and then they'll start talking about. They've already hired a contractor on an emergency basis to come in and do design work with them and get a new Parliament building going.
Well, as always, Giff, we really appreciate you coming through on the show and actually keeping us updated on this specific situation. So we thank you for your time this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And that is Giff Johnson, editor of the Marshall Islands Journal and a longtime contributor to Pacific Beat, on the line from Majuro. Time for some music. This is Nikki. It's Iko Keiao. Brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, the nine men found guilty of attempting to smuggle more than 4 tonnes of methamphetamine into Fiji will know their fate today in what will be one of the heaviest in the country's history.
Prosecutors have called for some of the harshest penalties in Fiji's history, 50 years for the top-tier organisers or the ringleaders, 30 to 35 years for trusted lieutenants, and 25 years for the others.
And that is our ABC reporter, Lethe Mavono, from Fiji. Now, you can find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But we'll be back same time at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow. You can hear us this afternoon, 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tua whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.